The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I listen to my mom, and I start listening to the teachers, and I start listening to these old people that gave me good values. They went to one ear and left the other. I didn't pay my attention. I became a man before time. I was calling sugar cane when I was only 14 years old, and the worst mistake of all, this one I got to take to the grave. Is when I drop out of school. In 1970, I decided to leave the island to make a better life. And I became what you call a migrant worker, a fruit picker. Still proud of it. Yesterday and today, my island still says St. Charles. So in 1970, I decided to leave the island, go to the state of Delaware, in a little town called Magnolia, to do farm work, to pick spider tomatoes, cucumbers, everything God created out there. Then after we finished the season there, I decided to go to the state of Florida. And this is what I can tell you about Florida. I have walked on certain roads, very dangerous roads in my life. But I never thought, never imagined that one day I would be convicted and sentenced to death for a crime I did not commit. This odyssey started in the month of February. I had to leave Florida early that year, because the citrus fruit got hit by the frost, and all the grapefruits and oranges, they fell down, and all we had to do was pick them up, and we was out of job in no time. So I had to migrate from the state of Florida all the way to the state of Pennsylvania, where I knew a farmer would give me a job pruning the apples and the peaches trees, getting them ready for the next harvest. And I never forget this day, May 2nd, 1984, a beautiful day. While we're eating lunch on the apple tree, here come a whole bunch of FBI agents with local police for that little town called Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. And they told us, they point gun at us, and they told us to hit the ground, and we did. Then they called my name, and I was scared to get up because of the weapons that was pointing at me. But I raised my arm. And then they told me to walk toward them. And I did. Then they told me to open my mouth. And I opened it. They wanted to see if I had a missing tooth. And I did. Let's get a little time for them to come in. So when I throw in my missing tooth, they bring me my rights. And they slap a handcuffs on me, throw me in a police car, and took me to a federal prison. A week after that, they took me in front of a magistrate, a federal judge, and he was talking about extradition. But I did not understand what extradition means at that time. I was naive to the language, naive to the law. So the only interpreter at that time to explain to me what extradition means, and all he told me in Spanish was, you either waive it or fight it. They will take you back anyway. So I'm not a killer. I did not commit this crime. My mama did not raise no killer. So I decided to waive extradition. I was thinking as soon as they see my ugly face in Florida, they will let me go. But how wrong of us. So I went into this, they extradited me all the way from the state of Pennsylvania, all the way to the state of Florida. Come on in. They took me in front of a judge, and the judge was reading the charges to me. You've been indicted, arrested, for first-degree murder and armed robbery in the state of Florida is sinking the death penalty against you. 2 weeks after that, they called me back to court to call upon a lawyer to me, a public defender. The truth is, I'm not O.J. Simpson. I don't have money to hire lawyers. This public defender used to come and talk to me, and I cannot understand what he was saying. He used to pat me in the back and tell me that everything is going to be all right. You're going home. I think he understood that, the home stuff. I did not commit this crime. I should go home. So now we're going to trial. Monday, we start picking the jury. Tuesday, we're still picking the jury. Tuesday evening after they pick 11 whites and one African-American person, a black man. They read instructions to the jury how to conduct themselves. And the first degree murder charge with the sinking of the death penalty. No Hispanics in the jury. And I'm Hispanic. Wednesday, the same week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. That's when the evidence comes in. This is what they had against me. They have what they call a police informant, what they call in the street a snitch. He claimed that I confessed the crime to him. He also implicates another subject in the crime, an African-American person, a black man, a friend of mine that I know. He gets arrested. He gets interrogated. He makes 15 statements. He incriminates himself in the crime. He gets charged with first-degree murder, armed robbery, and they threaten him with electric chair. It's time to make a deal. Prosecutor loves to make deals. So he was able to strike a deal with the state to testify against me. He gets his armed robbery charge, his first-degree murder charge, dropped to assess it after the fact. No more threat of the electric chair. He gets 2 years probation, the 2 years that he already had after I'm convicted and sentenced to death. Two questionable witnesses, no physical evidence against me. Two questionable witnesses with a record from here, criminal record from here to California. Two questionable witnesses that commit crimes and give lenity for their own crimes they commit. This is what I had in my favor on the defense side. I have what you call alibi witness. Both witnesses corroborating the alibi testimony. Other witnesses testifying, saying that the police informant, the snitch, had a grudge against me, but I had a problem. Every witness that I had was from the African-American race, a black man, a black woman. And when a black man and a black woman testified for the state, or some they got good credibility, they even dressed them. But when a black man and a black woman testified for the defense, a mastermind, or else the credibility is gone. Thursday, the same week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, they found me guilty. Friday, the same week, they sent me to death. And the judge complained that it was taking too long. When they sent me to death, my heart got full of hate. I became what you call an angry man. I hated the prosecutor. I hated the judge. I hated the juror, and I hated that one that pat me in the back, my trial defense lawyer, because I failed, he betrayed me. So now I'm going to jail. That was an ugly day, a day that I will never forget. Tuesday, November the 2nd, 1984. The place was horrified. The place was cold. The place was dark. They always kept me when they moved me with handcuffs, chains, and shackles. The place was also infested with roaches and rats. So they threw me down in the bottom floor in a single cell. 17 condemned death row inmates in that bottom floor. 17 condemned death row inmates in the second one and the third one. I made the 248 condemned men sentenced to death in the state of Florida, sent and reinstated the death penalty in 1976 in the nation. The fool. They bring the fool in a car, and the car is full of trays, and they bring that car inside the floor where you eat. And breakfast time, that's the worst time. They put the food in, they don't wake you up. And they put the breakfast in the flat that you have in your door, like a mail slot, in your cell door. And if you wait 5 seconds and you bunk to get up and get that breakfast, you run out of luck. You see, the roaches and beat you to it. They're waiting for the breakfast too. They get cold in northern Florida. So they supply you with a clean blanket. And I cover myself from toe, face and all. I don't want to see nothing. But the rats, they also get cold. And they want to get warm. So they climb that blanket. And I can feel that blanket rolling up and down. And when it lay in my chest, I get a good grip of the blanket. And I shake it real hard. And I can hear that rat hit the floor. Boom, it's a big man. As I told you before, I was real scared in there. And then they kill, they executed the 10 person in the state of Florida. When I leave that place, 51, today, 60. When they executed that 10 person, I got super scared. I arrived over there on a Tuesday, not the following Thursday, the next Thursday. That's when they executed that 10 person. So I'm thinking, I'm naive to the law. I do not know the process. I do not know the language. So I'm thinking, this is the thoughts in my head. They killing people here every week. How long is it going to be for them to come and get me? So I know how to box. And I know all the exercise. When you keep your muscle flexible, and you can swing your hands and fight to the end. So I'm thinking, if they come over here to get me, I'm just going to fight them to the end. And I'm walking to that chair. The truth is, I'm scared of electricity anyway. So I got to come up with a plan. I take the sheets on my bunk, and I tore them up in pieces, and I make little ropes with it. And I tie the bar doors. The bar doors slide like this. So I tie all these in. When they push the button in the control room, that door ain't moving nowhere. And I'm thinking, by the time they cut the ropes, I can get a good warm-up and fight these people to the end. So I'm doing push-ups. And I'm sweating real good. I'm around count time. And I'm trying to get muscle coming out of my eyebrows. Because I'm trying to intimidate these people. I'm trying to scare these people. But all the time, I'm the one intimidated. I'm the one scared. So here comes this African-American correction officer. Big, tall, black man, strong, doing the count. And he gets in front of my bars. And he gets angry because he sees the bar doors tied up. And he starts cursing. He says, Melendez, why you got the damn doors tied up? And I don't know no English, but I know how to curse. So I remind him of his mother, father, all the way down. we are. And then the rest of the condemned men, they got involved in the argument. And to my surprise, it's against me. They tell me that I'm wrong. So now I get angry with them. And I tell them the best way I can. I tell them, you mean to tell me that they're killing people here every week and we ain't doing nothing? We're supposed to fight these people. We're supposed to burn the place down. We Puerto Ricans don't go out like that. We fight to the end. They still told me that I was a fool. That all I do is get up in the morning and get in the bathrooms and nag and cry about my innocence and curse people out. They told me that I did not know how to read. I did not know how to write. I did not know no English. Did not know how to speak English. Then they told me the most beautiful thing I could hear. They told me they would teach me the worst of the worst. The most indescribable people in the nation. The one that the prosecutor called monsters thought this Puerto Rican had a right, had a read, and had to speak English. And believe me, if they would never help me, I would never have survived that place. I would not be able to communicate with them. I would never be able to communicate well with my lawyers. I'd not be able to reply the letters, the beautiful letters that the pen pal sent me. That gave me so much comfort, that made me feel that people care out there, that made me feel as a human being. And today, I will not be able to tell you this sad story. I spent 17 years, 8 months, and 1 day in Florida Death Row Prison for a crime I did not commit. After 10 years, I was tired of it. I wanted out of there. And the only way out is to commit suicide. And believe me, lots of my friends committed suicide. And I will tell you how to do it. They got what you call a runner. A runner is an inmate that's in prison population. He's not sentenced to death. He's a trustee. And they get him out of there so he can do the work in the death row facilities. The guard, the two is the guards don't do nothing. All they do is watch you and give you a hard time when they can. This runner, this trustee, this inmate that's not condemned to death, he is the one that supplies us with the food, with the toothpaste, the toothbrush, the soap, the mop and the broom so you can clean yourself. He also supplies you with a tool that you can kill yourself with. And he knows that. All you got to do is give him 4 stamps or a pack of cigarette rolling paper tobacco. And he will give you that tool. Perhaps these items are more important to him than your life. Or perhaps he thinks he is assisting you. You see, he works there. He knows that death row is hell. And he knows that you want out of there. The tool is real simple. It's a garbage plastic. Garbage can plastic. The one you see in the garbage cans around here. The strong one. You give him 4 stamps. And he will look when the guard looks, he will swing that bag inside his cell. You take that bag. You twist it raw, and you make a rope, and you put a noose. You put the noose in your neck, and tie the other hands in the bars. You throw yourself down, and you're dead, but you're free. That's what the demons used to tell me. Why you got to take this? Why you got to satisfy them when you can satisfy yourself? You're supposed to be a Puerto Rican man, a real macho man. Do it yourself. You say you didn't do it, you think they're going to believe you? They're going to kill you anyway. Do it yourself. And I start believing these thoughts. I never see my friend kill themselves because I cannot see through the walls. But I see when they wheel the body out. Something in the back of my head tells me, you're not going to look at your friend for the last time. So I grab a mirror and I stretch my arms to the bars. And this is what I see. I see a purple blue face that do not look like my friend. I also get to see something else too. That always stay in my mind. I get to see the noose in his neck. They never take the noose out. So now I want to take this trip. I'm tired of it. I want out of there. I tell the runner to give me that garbage bag. So I give him 4 stamps. And he swings that garbage bag inside my cell. I take that bag. I twist it all over. And I make a rope. And I put a noose in it. And I look at it, and I look at my bunk, and I say to myself, I better lay down and think about this a little bit more. So I take that rope, and I throw it under the bunk, and I lay down. When I lay down, I fall in a deep sleep, and I start dreaming that I'm a little kid again, doing the things I used to do when I was a kid, the things that make me happy, the good of all times. Like I told you before, I born in Brooklyn, New York, but I raised in the island of Puerto Rico. When I get up in the morning, on the east side of my house, it's a wonderful mountain. And if I walk 6 minutes to the south, I find myself in the most beautiful beach in the world, at least to me. So here I am in my dream, doing the things I used to do when I was a kid, the things that make me happy, the things that make me laugh, and the beautiful Caribbean Sea. The water is warm. The sun is bright. The sky is blue. The palm trees look so good. I'm having a ball there. I'm so happy. And then I get to see something I've never seen before. 4 dolphins coming my way. A pair get on one side. A pair get on the other side. And they start jumping and breathing like dolphins do. I'm playing with them. I'm loving every bit of it. Then I look to the shore, and I notice the old lady. She's jumping. She's waving her arms. She's smiling. She looks so happy. And I know why she's happy. She's happy because I'm happy. That's my dear mother. And then I wake up. When I wake up, the bunk smells like a beach. So I go under that bunk and grab that rope at this mate. And I walk straight to the toilet with it. And I look at it. And I look in the toilet. And I say to myself, I don't want to die. And I flush that rope in the toilet. But the truth is that it was lots of dreams. Lots of beautiful dreams. Every time I got depressed. Every time I go, I want it out of there. Every time suicide thoughts came to my mind, our Creator sent me a beautiful dream. And I grabbed all them dreams as a sign of hope. That one day I would be out of there. That one day I would be free. Like God was telling me, hey, I know you didn't do it, but I control the time. You get out. When I say you get out, you just got to trust me. And when I analyze everything, I come to this conclusion. It took 17 years, 8 months, and one day to also change the man. The death penalty is a penalty that should not exist in no part of the world. And it's our job, our duty as human beings to fight against it, whatever it is. You see, it brings what they call a lot of collateral damage on both sides of the family. On the family of the victim of homicide and on the family of the condemned man. When family is concerned, this is all I have. 5 aunts and mama. I got a lot of uncles, a lot of cousins, but none of them wrote, and brothers and sisters, but none of them wrote me a letter. But my 5 aunts and mama did. I don't know how the aunts are today, but in my time, in my generation, when I was growing up, if I do something wrong, and my aunt caught me doing something wrong, I'm going to get a good ass whooping. And I got to pray to God that she don't tell mama. Because if she tell mama, it's going to be another ass whooping. But when I was hungry, they feed me. When I needed a pair of pants, they bought it for me. And they wrote, they never forgot me. They believe in my innocence. They wrote me laughter letters. They sent me a lot of pictures of the ones that born that I never seen. And I saw grow to pictures, all of them. They love to keep the family together. And mama, I believe she suffered more than anybody. She wrote me lots of letters. And I got one that I always keep with me. And when I'm down and I need energy, I read it. And it helps me out. And it go like this. She wrote and say, son, I just built an altar. In that altar, I put a statue of the Virgin of the Guadalupe in it. And I pull roses. And I pray 5 rosaries a day. Thinking for the miracle. And she say, I know you're innocent. And God knows that you're innocent. But you got to put your trust in Him. And the miracle will come through 17 years, 8 months, and one day later, the miracle came through. Thank God for that. The conditions, especially the medical conditions. You better not get sick and therefore. You see, the Lord will use common sense. And the common sense is always against you. Why give you the best medication when the next day the government can decide you therefore? And kill you. Why waste the best medication on you? In order for you to understand the medical condition, the type of people that run this facility, unfortunately, I have to tell you another sad story. We go to the yard 4 hours a week, 2 hours on a Monday, 2 hours on a Wednesday, if it's not raining. They got a word today that the weathermen use a lot. And every time I hear it, it pisses me off. It ain't coming weather today. No yard. And it's not one drop of rain falling. There's a little cloud in the sky. But this day we did wait. all the ones that taught me how to read, how to write, and how to speak English. But very particularly, this African-American person, this black man, I call him brothers. They all taught me how to read and write and how to speak, but this one, he was pushy. You need to learn this. You need to learn that. And I love him dear for that, because I learned a lot from him. He also went to the yard. The brothers, they love to play basketball. Others, the other ones, they play volleyball. Lift weights. I lift weights because I can burn steam and go back to the cell and the press room. They don't have none of that no more. You see, the deputy in the state of Florida is run by the butcher ministers. And he has took all his hobby crap out. This crochet, this drawing, all that's gone. The weights, the volleyball, the basketball, all that's gone. He's trying to break the spirit of the condemned man. The will of heaven. If a condemned man in the state of Florida today went to commit suicide, all he got to do is waive his appeals, draft his appeals, and government Jeb Bush don't have no problem in signing his death warrant. You see, he is the runner now. He is the one that supplies that garbage bag. But going back to the soul in the yard, my friend, he was playing basketball. And he fell to the ground. When he fell to the ground, I stopped lifting weights. All of us stopped. We was concerned what's wrong with him. And we noticed that white foam was coming out of his mouth and nose. So we assumed it got to be a stroke, a heart attack. So we tell the guards in the gate, you have a man down. They need medical assistance. And they take their time. We're walking, talking. They call the clinic. Here comes the so-called nurse. A big, tall white man with a great belly. And he gets inside the gate and they told us to put our back to the fence. And from the gun tower, they point machine guns at us. And you better not move. They will shoot you. So now, the so-called nurse is inside the yard. This tall white man with a great big belly. I noticed he ain't had no medical bag. But he had something. He had about a half a pound chewing tobacco in his mouth. And you can see this black smoke that's running through his thighs. And every once in a while, he spits. I don't know if they got it down this end, but in the south of Wales, like, not the Carolinas, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, Texas, Louisiana, and Florida, they call them rednecks. So he's inside the yard. And we tell him, he's not breathing, he needs air. So he spits. And he says, I got to go back to the clinic and get an aspirin pack. So he walks real slow. Back to it. And then he going back, walking real slow. He gets inside the yard. He bends down, put the oxygen tank in my friend's mouth. Then he get up and we tell him, he's still not breathing. He need air. So he spits. And he say, I got to go back again to the clinic and get another oxygen tank. So I tell him, you don't have to. You can do CPR mouth to mouth. And tell him one of them, do mouth to mouth to a brother in the yard, in the ground. You're wasting your time. So he looks up. Then he looks down. Then he spits. And he made a statement using these two words. The M and the N. And I'm not going to put my mouth in there. So I tell him, you don't have to. I do it. You just do the counsel. And he agreed. And I'm so glad that he agreed. I'm trying to save my friend's life. So I rush down there. I take my t-shirt off. And I wipe that white foam he had his mouth and nose. And I bend down. And the so-called nurse, he starts counting. One, two, three. And I blow air. One, two, three. And I blow air again. One, two, three. And I blow air. My friend opened his eyes. I'm so glad he opened his eyes. I saw a sign of hope. He's going to live. But all of a sudden, his eyes rolled back. And he made a front with his face and mouth that I can see it right now. And then he breathed real hard and air came out. I think that was his older lesson because he died right in my arms. So I became angry again. And I want to do something to this so-called nurse that let my friend die in the yard like a dog. And when I was finished swimming, here come the rest of the condemned man. and grabbed me out of there and put me in the corner and told me, Puerto Rican Johnny, don't get in no more trouble than you already are in. We got other ways to handle this. I still go to confinement for 90 days for the respected member of the staff, whatever that means. But I learned a lesson. I learned how to think and look and trust something more bigger than the system. And the only thing I could see that was more bigger than the system is our Creator. The truth is, they condemn man that don't turn to something spiritual. He'll go crazy or commit suicide. Some of them become Muslims and they praise Allah and they teach others how to read, how to write, and how to speak, how to respect. Some of them become Buddhists. I don't know what they praise, but they teach others how to have compassion, how to love. And the most difficult thing to learn, at least to me, is how to forgive. Some of them become Christians. That's what I did. I had to go back to my head and remember everything my mama told me about Virgin Mary, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Ghost. And this is my personal opinion. I believe we serve in the same God with different names. That all we got to do is make good choices in life. Do good deeds, and we all go to heaven. This friend of mine, that the state of Florida, they didn't die in the yard like a dog. 1 month after his death, he wins a new trial. But the state of Florida, letting my friend die in the yard like a dog. The state of Florida denied my friend his right to prove his innocence. But enough of sad stories. Let me tell you how I got out of there. And I will tell you right from the jump. I was not saved by the system. I was saved in spite of the system. I was saved by the grace of God, by miracles. Here comes my lawyer with tears on her and dropping down her cheeks. And she tells me, she say, Johnny, I cannot handle your case no more. And I say, why? I don't need no new lawyers now. You know my case better than anybody. She tells me, you know why? I lost 5 clients. They all your friends. You know them. And don't misunderstand what I'm saying. When she says she lost 5 clients, she did not lose 5 cases. 5 of her clients got killed, got executed. If you're going to become a criminal lawyer, and you're going to deal with death penalty case, which I wish you do, because we need all the help we can. But be careful with the death penalty cases. They can get to you. But she tells me, I'm going to talk to the agency, and I'm going to get them to assign the 3 best lawyers they got and the best investigators. I finally got the dream team. So here comes my lawyer, and he tells me, he says, Melendez, you have lost too many appeals. And I say, yes. And the truth is, when you lose too many appeals, you're getting closer and closer to death. You become what they call in there, a prime candidate for the government to sign the death warrant. In my case, it was already in the case. But he tells me, we will try one more time. But if you lose this one, you'll be lucky if you live 3 years. I say, you're wrong. If I lose this one, I'd be lucky if I live a year and a half. You know who the governor of Florida is? Jeb Bush. He won't have no problem signing it. So he came up with this strategy. He said that he gonna send the investigator out to my child defense lawyer. Remember the one you took back in the back. To see if he had any files or they had missed something. And the first miracle occurred. My child defense lawyer. The one you took back in the back. He becomes a judge, and I'm so glad he became a judge. You see, by him becoming a judge, it gave me created what they call in the legal world, a conflict of interest. And that conflict of interest gave me the opportunity to move my case out of that racist county, out of the county where they fabricated the case against me, out of the county where the Global Oil Network operates, and it moved from Baltimore, Paul County, Florida, and by the way, don't go over there. He moved to Hillsborough County, Tampa, Florida, and they put in the hands of a courageous woman, of a woman that wants to do the right thing. Her name is Honorable Barbara Fletcher. George Barbara Fletcher. I can sincerely say that she saved my life. God bless her for that. So now my case is in another count. And here comes the investigator, trying to get some files from my trial defense lawyer who just became a judge. And he tells her, I'm a judge now. And I'm in a new office. But in the old office where I used to do defense work, it might be a box in there with the name Melendez written on it. So she rushed down there. And she pulled that box out of the chair. And she gets it. And papers. She look at the papers and the tape cassette. Fails to the floor. She takes the box back to the car and the papers. And remember that tape cassette. Come right back and pick it up. Took that tape cassette to her office and played. Guess what? The confession of the real killer was in that tape cassette. And my trial defense lawyer, the one used to pat me in the back, had that tape confession 1 month before trial. So this opened a can of worms. The case in the hands of a courageous woman, the one to do the right thing. All the problem I have with the judge was that they look at my case bit by bit. But Honorable Barbara Fletcher, she wanted the whole pie. She wanted to look at the entire case. So she immediately made a court order to the prosecutor's office and demanded he send any files to my case if he had any. And he did. Guess what? He also had a transcript copy of the tape confession of the real killer. And he had it 1 month before trial. He had something else. He had 16 documents that corroborated that tape confession. 16 documents that he never turned in to trial defense lawyer at the time of the trial were creating the legal world, a Brady Rule violation, withholding exculpatory evidence, prosecutor misconduct. But that time, I already had 3 investigative hearings, and I was able to establish around 20 witnesses that I don't even know that testified that the man that confessed in that tape is the real killer, because he confessed to them, including the wife of the real killer, including the real killer's sister, including law enforcement officers, a former prosecutor investigator, a former FBI agent, criminal lawyers, and friends of the killer. You see, the real killer was also a police informant. So, in the end, they even found physical evidence against the real killer. So now, Honorable Barbara Fletcher got all this ammunition, and she decided to write a 72-page opinion. And that 72-page opinion, she chastised the prosecutor for the way he handled the case. She chastised law investigators for the way they investigated the case. And she chastised the one that passed in the back, my child defense lawyer, for the way he called himself defendant. And she ordered a new trial and wrote down that the case was terrible damage, that everything in the case, you have an innocent man and death row. The prosecutor decided not to appeal the judge's decision. The prosecutor decided not to process the case. The prosecutor decided to drop it. And that's why I'm here, thank God, talking to all you now. I never knew the day I was going to be released. It caught me talking by surprise. Here comes two officers in front of my cell and tell me that I had a photo call out. The photo call out means they want to take a picture of you because you're going outside court, but you're coming back. They want to know how you look before they let you out there to go outside court in case something happened down the road. They want to see how that face looked. So, and you never in front of an officer without handcuffs and shackles and chains. And they slap your handcuffs from the inside the cell to the flat that you got in your cell door. You give him all your clothes and he searches. Then he do what they call a corporal search. And believe me, it's very humiliating. They want to see everything. And then, after that, they give you the clothes back, you put it on there, and you turn around, they slap the handcuffs on you to the flap that you got in the door cell. And then they open the door. When they open the door, they ain't through with you yet. They put shackles in your legs, changing the ways, and they change the handcuffs to the front, and they put a black box that connect with the handcuffs, and they twist your arms like this, and you walk like a zombie, like a penguin. So now I'm going downstairs, and from downstairs I gotta hit it in a van with four correctional officers escorting me, and it's right there. Peaceful police is right there. But they called themselves not to parade alleged killer around prison population. So when I get to the place where they're going to take this photo, I noticed that a whole bunch of guards, police officers was coming towards me. And every one of them had white shirt. And when you see a guard with white shirt, you see a guy with higher rank. The colonel, the lieutenants, the captains, the superintendents, the warden of the prison. All of them was in there. And I got scared. I forgot that I had a new trial. I'm thinking these people inside my death warrant. I don't trust them. So I locked my legs. I ain't moving nowhere. And they ordered me to move. And I refused. And here comes the big man in prison, the warden. And he gets behind me. And he backs me in the back. And I look at him. And he reminds me of my child defense lawyer. I'm thinking, if I'm zooming here, they're going to kill me. Then Spanish officer. He starts speaking Spanish. And he tells me in Spanish, he said, Melendez, don't start no trouble here. Move. You're going to the information room. And I believe you got good news. I'm still skeptical, paranoid, and scared. But I decided to make a move. So they move him. They take me to the so-called information room. They set me in a chair. And in front of me is a desk. Behind the desk is a lady working the computers. And she starts making some crazy questions. She asked me for my social security number. And I'm thinking, why in the hell she want to know my social security? But I give it to her. I know it by heart. Then she came with another crazy question. Where you going to live at? Who you living with? And the last one was that pushed me off. What kind of job you got? And I'm going to give her a real look. Because she got up of the chair and put both hands in the table and looked straight at my eyes. And she say, you do not understand what's going on in here, do you? I say, lady, I don't have this right idea. I live across the streets. I've been in there for almost 18 years. I'm in death row. They don't have no jobs in death row. Then she tells me, we're fixing your paperwork. We they're going to release you today. And I don't know if you watch cartoons. And you see this cartoon character, and grab a sledgehammer. And he's the other one in the head with. And you see that knot that's come straight up. And then you see he got stars going around his head. And he's in a state of shock. But he's smiling. That's how I was. In a state of shock. But smiling. And I'm still smiling today. Then the officers, they start acting different. They offer me sandwiches and soda pops. And I told them, I don't want no sandwich. I don't want no soda pop. I want to go back to my cell and pack everything up and get the hell out of here. And then they start calling me something they never called me before. They start calling me Mr. Melendez. And I liked that. So they move real fast. I never seen them work so fast. And I was first for everything. By the time I get to my cell, everybody in death row know that I was going to be released. Then I hear steps in the catwalk. And all of a sudden my cell door opened, flat open. And I got scared again. And then I noticed two officers inside my cell and the captain of the prison. So I immediately turn around so they can slap the handcuffs on me. And when one of the officers put the handcuffs on me, the captain of the prison told me, no. You don't put no handcuffs on Mr. Melendez today. Mr. Melendez is a free man. Mr. Melendez is going home. Mr. Melendez walk out of here without handcuffs. I like that too. And then I want to say goodbye to my friend in the last cell. I'm in the cell next to last. And when I come out of the cell, I got a smile on my face. Tears that's running down my cheeks. I'm happy, but part of me is sad. I could not say nothing to him. I just looked at him. Part of me is sad because I'm leaving and I got to leave them behind. The one that taught me, the ones that taught me how to read, how to write, how to speak English. And I was thinking, if we don't abolish the death penalty, I know what's going to happen. They're going to kill them all. But he was able to talk. And this was his exact words. He said, they don't get in no trouble there. He said, take care of yourself. Then he said, don't forget about us. And the last thing he said was, and take care of your mama. They all know my mama. So now, I'm walking. And that's about every one of them is telling me the same thing. And before I get to that door that will lead me out of that floor, out of that wing, I hear a clap. Then I hear a second clap. And I hear a third clap. And I hear a whole bunch of claps. It was making so much noise of joy and happiness that the guards got angry at them and told them to be quiet. They stopped clapping their hands and making that noise to a left that place. They was really happy to see me go. So now I'm in the door that will lead me out to freedom. And this is what I see. I saw a whole bunch of reporters, CNN and everybody was in there. And no offense, no disrespect, but a reporter sometimes makes some silly questions. The first one was, how do you feel? And I told her how I feel. I feel good. I'm going home. I'm a free man. Then comes this female reporter with some more crazy questions. Where are you going? What you want to do? What you want to see? And I told her that I want to go to Disney World. I told her, it came just like that in the paper. And it came naturally. I told her that I wanted to see the moon. I wanted to see the stars. I wanted to walk on grass, on dirt. I wanted to hold a little baby in my arms and play with it. Of course, I told her I wanted to talk to some beautiful women. That reporter I had in front of me, she was ugly. The thing is, I miss the thing that we take for granted. The simple things in life. I cannot understand the people in the free world when they tell me they're bored. I was bored at the inside. It's too many things that got great for us that we can enjoy and appreciate. It's too many good deeds that we can make. Too many good choices that we can make. I ain't got no business being bored. Nobody got no business being bored. I'm the type of man that I can sit on a rock and look at a mountain for hours and hours and enjoy every bit of it. To conclude this, I got to tell you this much. I'm still a dreamer. I dream and pray to God every day that in my time I can see the death penalty abolished. But this thing cannot come true without all your help. You got to get involved in this. That's like we got rid of segregation. That's like we got rid of slavery. We also can get rid of this mandate. You see, as long as the death penalty law around, it's always going to be a chance to kill an innocent man. So join some type of organization. You have a good one here in the States. National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And get all the facts about the death penalty. The problem we have with the death penalty is this. People don't have the facts about it. You got to educate them. And that's how you get rid of the problems in society, by education. You got to tell them, once the people know the facts, the real facts about the death penalty, they will find out that it's a bad government policy. You got to write legislators and let them know that it's safe to go against the death penalty. See, politicians, they are like this. They get up in the morning and open the window and they stick their finger out. Wherever the wind blows, that's where the finger is going. Our job is to change the direction of the wind. So write legislators. You got a voice. Let it know that we don't believe in the death penalty. That it's a bad government policy. With that, I leave you. God bless you. I love you all. Peace and love to you all.
Lunch is in free for us at 12:40, so we could do questions for a little bit. Like 10 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
We could do questions for like...
Yes, no problem.
Minutes.
No problem.
Do you guys have questions?
I'm just wondering what exactly does happen. I mean, you left there, and now you're free, but... I mean, does the system offer you any type of assistance in finding a place to live, finding a job, or is it just... Okay, go ahead.
And believe me, that's a very, very intelligent question. I'm one of the lucky ones. It's been 121 released from death row. I'm the number 99 in the nation, and the number 24 in the state of Florida, which leads the nation on a Senate release from death row with 25. I'm the number 24. When I got out, there's two condemnments that I know that is different from all the residents. That's Joaquin Martinez, a friend of mine that got out 8 months before me in the state of Florida. He's the number 23, and I. When we got out, he's from Spain. So when he went to Spain, they treat him like a hero. They offered him jobs, and he's doing very well. They saw him last year in Madrid, Spain. He's doing real good. Thank God. I was treated the same way, a hero in the island. That's about everybody know me in the island. They offer me a job. I cannot take the job because if I take the job, I cannot do what I'm doing now. I got a job in there that's flexible. I work in a planting field that is owned by a friend of mine. And I can work and leave and come back and still got the job. No problem. We grow up together. We're just like two brothers. Most of the ones that got released, a lot of them already back in prison. Some of them into drugs. Some of them have become alcoholics. And believe me, some of them have committed suicide since they've been out. It's no help for the sentences. It's not like when you get out of parole. When you get out of parole, the parole officer will make sure that you have a job and a place to stay. They were tore out, and that's it. They never gave me no. The only thing they gave me was $100, a pair of pants, and a T-shirt. And they do that to anybody to any senator that don't have to be from death row. Can be from prison. He finishes time, he's gone. No supervision. So we don't have no help. We are in our own. We're working on that. We're trying to build organizations that could help us. One of the things that help us a lot is when we get together and we tell the things that we suffer. See, that's about every SNRE suffer what I do, including myself, we suffer what they call post-traumatic distress, what Vietnam veterans suffer. So we got that problem. And when we get together, we tell him his problem, and I tell him mine, and we find out that he's not alone. In other words, that helped us a lot. But that's about it. We need help, lots of help, to overcome this. And it's a disease that might never be cured, but we can learn how to live with it. We can learn how to take a negative situation and try to make something positive about it. That's what I do.
Most states don't offer any monetary compensation to people who are wrongfully convicted. A couple do, but usually the cap is $150,000 for like lost wages and the time that someone spent in jail even though they were not guilty. And then most states won't even remove the criminal charge from your record even though you were exonerated. So people who get out are still... can't get jobs or have trouble being on offenders lists in neighborhoods because it's still a criminal record that they carry.
Pues mira.
Why did the defendant, your attorney, why did he fail to submit all evidence? Was he linked to the...
It's a good possibility. You got to remember this is a 20-year-old case, and it happened in a racist county. So I don't know if the prosecutor and him was working together. He claimed that he could not show the tape confession of the real killer because it violates hearsay rules. However, what gets me is, and I'm not a lawyer, he never introduced the tape confession. He never put the tape confession on record. If he would have put it on record, the appeal lawyers would have grabbed that tape confession and probably would know what to do with it. You see, that's what I'm very skeptical of. Prosecutor and him might be working together. Go ahead, Sean.
When you entered jail and you couldn't speak English and you couldn't read or write, do you ever think that you go back and maybe start a program for inmates so they can learn to read and write?
It's a good thought, and I wish I had time to do it, but and this is the thing they should be working on in rehabilitation, instead of giving them specialized pills. That's what they're doing now. Everything has changed inside. They're not doing too much no more in rehabilitate them. It's a good thought. I got most of my time I spent in trying to abolish it, but that's another way to get into something to get into.
Why don't you become a lawyer, Warren?
Because it's a headache. It's not an easy job, and I'm very proud of the ones that study and become lawyers. I'm very proud of them, but to me it's a big headache. You got to like it to be a lawyer. You got to really like it.
Who thinks we ought to give Juan an honorary degree from AU Law School?
Any more questions? Go ahead, my friend.
What part of Puerto Rico are you from?
I'm from a little town called Maunabo. Thank you for asking. Little town called Maunabo, about an hour and 45 minutes from San Juan. It's in the coast. I have mountains. And like I said before, the most beautiful beach in the world, right in front of my house.
When you were locked up, did you ever think about trying to escape?
You only can dream about it, mi amigo. But yes, always think about that, but it's all a dream. Yes, I speak and I even spoke to elementary kids. And when I like to talk to them, they say you got to talk to them in a different way. First thing I do, they all sitting on the floor, so I sit on the floor right on with them. And I had a lot of fun with them. Yes, I speak to all kinds of audience. That's a good question. The problem with that is the state of Florida have what they call immunity. In other words, immunity protect them from suits and all that stuff. I would do a lot of work in the state of Florida. I was able to convince two legislators, by the way, two Republicans, to introduce bills, to introduce a bill that will, if a prosecutor or law enforcement normally know that he have an innocent man in their hands and they still process the case, hold him accountable for. The other bill is to pay compensation for the ones not only released from death row for the crime they did not commit, also the ones that be released from prison.
After being in jail for so long, what was the first thing you did when you got out? I wanted to eat the
fast food, a hamburger and all that stuff, and believe me, as soon as I ate it, he fell like a rock. I threw it right back up.
In the state of Florida, is there a certain limited amount of appeals
when you're in death row? In death row, they tend to cut down the appeals. But thanks for the good judges, they've never been successful. As long as you have some ground that you can prove you're innocent, you have a chance to appeal. The problem with this is that sometimes evidence gets lost,
lots of things can happen. One of the things the reason I'm against the death penalty is because you can sentence a person to life in prison, and 12 years later you find out he did not commit the crime. You can give him his life back, but you cannot do it with the death penalty. It's an irrevocable error. So that's one of the, in the law say, hey, they have a death penalty around. It's always going to be a chance that you can kill an innocent man. So that's why we got to get rid of it. Oh yeah, that's a good question. I'm glad you made it. I don't agree with it, but I know you have to give people something. And it's another fight, but life without parole. The truth is, it's people in there that you don't want to see. It's people in there that you got to throw away the key. But you still can, do time and teach them, doing the time and teach them with dignity as human beings. Class
Thank you.
Okay.
What happened?
San Francisco.
Oh, San Francisco.
Which one is it?
You don't really see it. They're killing us like this. When it falls down to it,
even the ones that believe in you, so they don't want to kill us.
Yeah, it's not right.
Well, but they don't have the facts. Once you give them the facts, they have to kill
them. They're being killed. I go to half Spanish, half Muslim, media, all black and Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
For no reason.
We all Muslim in our heart. I know about that.
Yeah. No innovation.
There you go. They got white Muslims.
Yeah.
You know that a lot.
Yeah. It's Islam with no motivation. You heard of Willy Bosky? The New York kids. The dogs and all. You have a situation. That's when you get our views. Two of my cousins were in New York.
Well, they're living in New York. I did a lot of work over there. I talked to the key over there, that
Langston. That's why he's still alive.
Yeah, we got a bit over there. We did a lot of work over there, a lot of work.
Yeah.
I grew up in New York.
Yeah, I think
we know. I've been in the team and everything I've
done. Yeah. We were the Rockefeller. Everybody was
here. I had to go to New York in November, sometime in November. You might see you down there.
Okay.
Yeah, have to go down. I've been down there in a spoken temple that the university with Bill Coffey.
Yeah, please do.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.